Dude, we are going to energize the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Brooks, who is a Professor of Law and Government and Dean of Durham Law School at the University of Durham. He's a member of the Fabian Society's Executive, a policy advisor to the Labour Party, and also chair of the Sedgefield branch of the Sedgefield Constituency Labour Party. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Will. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on. So my first question is, obviously the Labour Party has recently seen a quite severe defeat in the last year's general election. What do you think were the underlying factors behind that defeat?
Wow. There are quite a few. I mean, I've had to, there's basically a couple sides to this. The two main kind of views are folks on one side of the equation say, you know, that it boiled down to the leader, that Jeremy Corbyn was the primary cause. Others on the so-called other side claim the position on Brexit was and that's then reinterpreted to mean kind of being for a second referendum. I think it was a combination of probably both and some other things. So without going any longer than you'd want me to on this, I think it's undeniable. You know, one doesn't have to kind of, you know, believe every poll to know that every poll showed that Jeremy Corbyn was unpopular with large parts of the public. He was when specifically on questions like, you know, who do you see as a prime minister, not, you know, do you think someone is, you know, seems all right or things like this. In America, they have things like, you know, who would you rather have coffee with? And that was apparently a deterrent, you know, and so more people thought they could have a cup of coffee with George W. Bush rather than Al Gore. And that was apparently one of the factors that was thrown at Al Gore as to why, you know, how he could have improved electability. I think with Corbyn, he was, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, did find him likable, but there was an issue about leadership that was in the minds of others, and it was undeniably a factor on the doorstep. When I spoke to people, it came up probably more than anything else. It's true that the Brexit position wasn't helpful either, but there, I think it's always important to remember what the heck the position was. I mean, Labour had decided formally to not take a side on Brexit, that it was not for it. It was not against it. It was going, you know, the big idea was vote for a Labour government and it will somehow negotiate some new deal in a matter of months, which I thought was probably would be very difficult to achieve. But anyway, it would have, in a couple months, there'd be a new deal and Labour would put it to the public whether or not they wanted the Labour deal or no deal, but without campaigning for its own deal and without campaigning to remain. And so, I mean, which is very different from, say, the second referendum view, or what was called the second referendum view, right, of Liberal Democrats and a lot of anti-Brexit campaigners, where second referendum meant you have a referendum on Brexit where there's someone arguing for Remain. And I remember being in the room at the Labour Party annual conference when, presumably with the leader's blessing, it was their motion to accept a second referendum, but without taking a side. And I think that criticism of the party of and I could see why that happened. And there was arguments for it that were all right, and there were some arguments against it that I was probably more persuaded by. But you know, that was the view, and the criticism that, you know, here's the biggest political question in modern history, and Labour's plopped itself right on the fence and can't decide and can't take a view, I think was incredibly damaging. But I also think that the policies were an issue. The policies were not an issue in terms of necessarily what they were per se, you know, I'm absolutely, as a university professor, I'm all for ending fees to universities. So I'm glad that policy remains. So don't get me wrong, I'm not about to start unpicking the policies. But there's quite a few things in the manifesto. It was difficult to kind of draw attention to any, you know, what the kind of core message was of the party. And that was complicated by the way in which the party tried to personalize the manifesto. So there was the manifesto for everybody that you can, you know, find and was published. There was then, I thought, an interesting idea, manifestos for regions, right? So you had the kind of the national manifesto to kind of memorize and know what that's supposed to do. And then there was something that was different for the Northeast, where I am. There's something different for the Northwest and Midlands and other things. And it's like, okay, that's complicating it. And then you could go into the website, you can kind of come up with, you can kind of, you know, tick on things of importance to you and get like your own individualized manifesto. And I think that, you know, while we want to make concrete, we want to make these things kind of real for voters, you know, that was a very difficult thing. You know, it was quite literally showing someone, each person, something different about what Labour had to offer. Whereas, you know, what was Boris going to do? You know, the Johnson and his team were just going to, you know, get Brexit done. They didn't tell you what that meant. They didn't tell you what that was. They certainly haven't done it. You know, Brexit we're still in a transition period with no agreement in sight on a new trade deal. But you had a kind of a greater sense of clarity as to what they wanted to do by keeping it simple, stupid, as the old campaign crude slogan goes. And that was effective. People effectively knew what they stood for. And I think that message on Brexit that the other side had, I think what really kind of went home with it wasn't that they somehow were for leave and that's what everybody just wanted, because that was never the case, that everyone was just for leaving the European Union. That wasn't really it. Though I do think there was a very solid majority for, you know, not just getting Brexit done, but getting talk about Brexit done. Mm. I think people were sick. If you're not kind of political anoraks like you and I, you get, you know, get very interested and involved and knowledgeable about the different things going on, most people were just sick to death, you know, of what the latest, you know, chat was in a meeting and who had the best notes and what was said or what wasn't. They just said, okay, we want this thing over with so we can kind of plan our businesses, plan our lives, you know, plan our futures, and expected the politicians to kind of get on with it one way or the other. And so I think that sense of clarity that we would not be talking about Brexit all the time, consolidating the Leave vote in so doing, that having that kind of clear message, were things that clearly helped the other side, versus Labour, that had an unpopular leader, was seen to be sitting on the fence on the biggest political issue of that time, and had a manifesto that seemed to say different things to different people depending on who you were and where you were, where you lived.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you have worked as an advisory role with both Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer. And I wonder, what do you think are the differences in the way that the two of them interact with ideas? Or are they quite similar in the way that they engage with ideas?
Well, I had my first break with Ed Miliband. I met him at my quite literally on my 40th birthday at a Labour North event. And I got in a lot of trouble with my family when I was trying to explain how I was not going to go out celebrating on my 40th with friends and be out in a pub or somewhere, but instead wanted to attend a political event, all for the purposes of getting to meet Miliband. I got to know his brother David when he was an MP up here in the Northeast in South Shields. I wanted to meet Ed to convince him that he needed an immigrant to advise him on immigration. And quite literally everyone I know and worked with thought I was completely nuts. But I did it, as everyone's trying to get their selfies and all sort of stuff like that, you know, with him. I just kind of went straight in and you know, said who I was and the work that I wanted to do. I wanted to advise his team. I'd certainly never done anything like it before, but I was up for it. I knew something about immigration law and policy, having done it firsthand, and I was up for it. And he was great. And within about a week, I got a letter inviting me to become an advisor to his team. And that's something that I think I got that 2013 or so, and I've been doing that ever since. What was interesting, you mentioned the different, potential differences between Corbyn and Starmer. They're both so different from Miliband. So with Miliband, I felt I was meeting regularly with his chief advisor on home policy affairs, a guy called Harvey Redgrave, and doing primarily, if not exclusively, work for the manifesto. So, for example, I was researching the then it made it into the manifesto about making frontline public workers be fluent in English, stuff like that. So I was kind of doing kind of small reports on that, and basically putting a professor who can do some research to good use in confidence. So my kind of particular things I was doing at the time would be in strict confidence, but it was great. I learned a lot as I was doing it, and it was wonderful. However, I'll never forget, Will, how I was in Harvey, because I was really pushing for immigration to get a bit more profile from Miliband's labor, thinking that we were kind of giving up the ground. We were taking criticism from all sides that I thought was unfair. And, people are calling more and more for a points-based immigration system. Well, if that's really such a great idea, and that's the only thing the right had to go for, they thought that was their kind of trump card. Well, actually, there's been a points-based system in the UK since 2008. It was put into force by a Labour government, and I should know because I'm a non-EU person, and we go through that points-based system. So there already was one, and so people, from Nigel Farage to Boris Johnson and Michael Gove and others arguing to launch one, I thought, we've clearly, they really don't know what they're doing. And if that's such a great idea, we're already doing it. Anyway, I got somewhere in with the party because he called me down for a meeting, and I very excitedly hopped on the train to meet him in a cafe not far from Westminster. And he said, we're going to put in the manifest in the we're going to have it as a pledge. I said, what's that? We're going to have controls on immigration. And I said, great. Which ones? right? Because I've been spending a lot of time drawing up all these different policies that could be explored. And so no, just controls on immigration. I said, that sounds awful. The rest is history, isn't it? Mugs and all. So with him, I felt like I had done a lot of work for that team. But I was given lots of reassurances that lots happened behind the scenes with my work that I had done, I didn't feel anything kind of really materially happening with it. I was a bit frustrated at that time. But, was new to the game and just glad to have a foot somewhat inside the door. With Jeremy Corbyn and team, even though I'm born in New Haven, the same city that George W. Bush was born in, I live in Sedgefield constituency, of course represented by Minister Tony Blair. So I have a connection of sorts to two people that Corbyn and company certainly don't have the most positive views of. And lots of talk by people who don't know him very well about the factions and how factional things are and so on. It was not my personal experience. I remember the first time I made the same pitch to Jeremy about, I'm an immigrant, I'd like to help you with immigration. And he hugged me and said, welcome. and he was great. Judged me on my merits. I was very quickly connecting with Harvey Redgrave's replacement, which is a chap called Lachlan Stewart, and who's fabulous and remains a dear friend. And it was interesting, so while I had, no previous connection whatsoever to anyone on the so-called inner circle, with the possible exception of Laura Pidcock, who was a friend of mine before she became an MP, I had no inside anything to anybody and no connection whatsoever. In fact, you know, a lot of connections I had had, I built with Ed Miliband, of course, had gone when Jim McCormick became leader. I was a bit nervous. But actually, you know, coming forward, you know, at that time, you might remember, you know, a lot of MPs weren't kind of working with the leader's office. A lot of people had kind of turned away. And so you had this kind of rush of a lot of new, really exciting activists joining the party, which was absolutely fabulous. But you did have some folks who had some experience and had been around a bit, who, for whatever reason, decided to become less active or to leave the party, unfortunately. And I found it just a kind of a real open door for me. You know, there were lots of folks surrounding Corbyn who had very strong views on, say, you know, how we should treat asylum seekers and refugees in a progressive way. But there was not so much, there wasn't a long queue at the door of folks who knew anything substantive about the details and how they might be reformed on other areas of immigration in particular. And so now the only two that were an exception to that were Diane Abbott, who used to work in the Home Office, and Shami Chakrabarty, who of course became, I think, Shadow Attorney General and had Home Office experience too. So they both kind of were clued up, were keen to have somebody who knew something about things. And Diane was always kind of really warm towards me. I grew a very fast friendship with, when Corbyn became leader, with the newly elected and newly appointed Shadow Immigration Minister, one Keir Starmer. I met him within a week or two of his becoming a Member of Parliament. We hit it off immediately, as I also have a long history of doing work in criminal law and sentencing, and have written about sentencing and have taken part in an initiative that he had started with the CPS when the BPP, and he was really quite pleased to see someone who understood that background that he had in criminal law, someone that came from a law school. He was a law school graduate of Leeds. He studied in Yorkshire. And he was exceptionally smart, so liked having a law professor around, felt we could communicate pretty openly and pretty freely. And then was just very interested to know more about immigration, because that was not an area of law that is covered in most law degrees. It's not a qualifying subject. And so he was just keen to have someone else around. So, and he also tweeted some very nice things about my book. So Keir was kind of great. So Jeremy Corbyn's team were wonderful to me. He was replaced by Afzal Khan, who became a very close friend and was also terrific. And I think to summarize it, I think that both Corbyn and Starmer's teams have been very positively open to new ideas, to new people contributing. There's been opportunities to do so that were not there, in my view, or at least not open to me, before, whereas both Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer have opened up to this kid born from somewhere else, strange accent, lives up in the Northeast and has no familiar connections to anything here. But they both have been really great. If anything, I think Starmer seems keen to accelerate that a bit and has been kind of even more open to getting advice and support from the academic community and others as well. But you know, similarly, you know, just really kind of to a degree building on a lot of things that happened, in my view, with Corbyn, at least on the home affairs front that I work on.
Now, of course, one of the things that has greatly involved immigration has been Brexit and the ways that that will change our relationship with the rest of the world. If Labour is able to win the next general election, which will, of course, will be after Brexit, how do you think that will impact Labour's immigration policy?
Well, I still remain a bit doubtful, not hopeful. I remain doubtful that the government is going to get all its ducks in a row by the end of the year. Yes, they have things in law. Yes, it'll be very difficult for things to go off track. But yes, also, a no deal, which is presumably where we're headed to right now, on the back of what might be an oncoming second wave of a coronavirus, talk about a bad mix of stuff to hit the country economically. We haven't left the transition period yet. And I have some people say, well, Tom, Boris Johnson and others, they just keep saying, and they mean it, that they want to leave and they're going to do things and Brexit. And I say, well, look, if the resolve to get Brexit done was enough to complete that project, Theresa May would have done it 2 years ago. She had every incentive to so-called get Brexit done. And there were lots of reasons and not just party political why that was a challenge. I mean, one thing that's happened the last few weeks was a consultation as to on a topic that I raised with Keir when he was shadow Brexit secretary, the issue of if we Brexit, what's the current position on law? The current position on the law is that what has been incorporated already from the EU in British law will effectively be frozen in time, and that it will effectively be, unpicked or reformed over time. So, for example, it's not going to be the case that all our consumer protection will necessarily end, or maternity rights will necessarily end on the 1st of January. It will stay because this has been kind of effectively reincorporated in UK law by an act of parliament. My point to Keir was, well, hang on a second. What do they mean by EU law? If they mean legislation from the EU Parliament and other things, okay, that's fine. But also, there's the holdings of the European Court and of Justice, and that this is standing too. And I haven't seen any list of which doctrines from which cases will be frozen in time as well. And until that happens, we seem to be missing, if not the law, then how it should be applied. Which we need by Brexit Day, and Keir seemed to agree with that. Well, the government is only a week or two ago put out a consultation, which is ongoing, by the way. So your listeners are very welcome to look this up, gov.uk, and fill out the consultation. I'm displaying their full legal knowledge, but the government's trying to find out now which European Court of Justice decisions stick or should stick, and what does that mean, and where do they find them? It's August, Prime Minister, so it's really quite remarkable. They've quite literally left that to the end. You would think they'd have a list somewhere, but no. The House of Commons Library does have a list of different bits of EU law that are frozen in time, effectively, but it's not very helpful library briefings has not given a list of the court judgments. So I'm not optimistic about Brexit. I've always thought Brexit was going to be delayed, not because I didn't want Brexit, but because I thought Brexit was just so damn hard to do. It was a lot more difficult to make a reality than I think its proponents thought. Not because anyone isn't smart enough or has the wrong political values, or I don't think any of that. I think lots of smart people were for Brexit and have fine values, but the issue is just it's a very complicated project that can't be done quickly, and I think that's the primary reason things are being delayed. Brexit hasn't, the transition period continues, and I'll believe it's ended when the clock strikes 11 o'clock at night on the 31st of December. That's when you've got me that Brexit has happened. That's when I'll believe it, but not yet until then. Again, because of just pragmatism, not optimism. Mm. But if there was Brexit, so I gave you a long caveat, but if Brexit happens the way in which Prime Minister says it will, and we're well and truly out. What do these things mean for immigration? Well, I think one of the things that it will mean is that assuming the government with its majority of 80 will effectively get its way on a new immigration system, and I've no reason to doubt that it will get its way. Now, it's not going to be quite, as they were told by the Migration Advisory Committee, a group of five labor economists who advise independently the government. None are a member of any party. They advise on basically the shortage occupation list and some other matters of immigration policy. They were asked by the government to do an analysis of how a points-based system might look like, how it might be launched, and how it might apply to all areas. Mm-hmm. And Migration Advisory Committee, it was hilarious. The then director, Professor Manning at LSE, had to remind the government that, excuse me, Mr. Prime Minister, but, how do I put this? There's already a points-based system in place. Don't you donuts know this? And that, broadly speaking, you know, was it perfect? Not at all. Could it be reformed? Totally. But are we talking about reforming, rejigging what exists? Are we talking about something wholesale? We're talking about rejigging the system. So they were absolutely against kind of creating some kind of point table for how you can get a family member here. Mm. Or, you know, are you a student or not? Or other types of things. So they had some kind of real, and said things like, you know, no country in the world that has a points-based system does that, as families, you know, you have to make sure that your wife or husband or somebody else meets some points threshold in order to kind of bring your child here. Mm. That's not how that works in the United States or any country. So there's this kind of interesting kind of question around that. Of course, looking to Australia, particularly for a points-based system, and though not looking to Canada. America, of course, is a different non-points thing that they do. Mm. But I think we're looking at a reality of a points-based system that, you know, one that Labor started in a project, I think, that we could reform and fix. And I think could be done in a number of ways. I mean, what would these things kind of look like? Well, this is something that I think the party will be reviewing shortly, you know, ahead of drawing up its own plans for a new manifesto as to kind of what this thing might look like. But a few kind of general thoughts. I mean, one is, you know, the government talks about, if I can just give you a few details, I don't want to say more about points-based things than you care to hear. But the government says stuff like, everyone will be required to know English. That's not true, right? It's absolutely not true. If you go into the further details, the further guidance, excuse me, for their, which was published last month, it makes clear that there are categories of migration. I believe they include what used to be called Tier 1 Investor, but the Global Talent Investor Scheme. So if you've got enough money, don't worry, mate. We won't be asking you for an English test. There's also exemptions. There's a number of exemptions depending on what country you come from. There are some other visa streams in which you will not be, you are not required to prove knowledge of English above any particular thresholds, certainly not fluency as well. And they also make kind of curious exemptions, such as if you come from a country that does not speak English and study a degree somewhere in English, even in a country whose citizens are not on the list as exempted, you can be exempt. So, for example, Kazakhstan is not on the list. I'm picking a country out of random. Kazakhstan's not on the list. The English is not a primary language there, but the main university does teach in English. So if you have an English degree from Kazakhstan, of whatever you think of what degrees are elsewhere, that counts every bit as much as having passed a test for, you know, having satisfactory fluency in a speaking listening test here in the UK. And that sounds to me nuts. And also, of course, being an American, I know full well there are millions of my compatriots who are wonderful people and are equally American citizens who do not know much English at all. And the fact that all Americans are given an exemption is no guarantee that everyone knows any English. It's not just a matter of kind of knowing enough English, knows any English. So one thing I would want a Labour government to do is to want to actually enforce the standard, because I think the government is certainly willfully misleading the public. But the Home Secretary and Prime Minister surely must know that not everyone is actually required to know English. That'd be one thing. The other is, I don't think it should only be English either. So I think, you know, integrating to some parts of the UK and parts of Wales and Scotland, Welsh and Scots Gaelic might be better for that. Mm. These are languages that were more commonly made available for people to do the citizenship test on, although very rarely that was taken up. And, you know, I think that should be brought back, that if someone who comes from another country moves to, say, Wales and wants to learn Welsh, when I've traveled to Aberystwyth, say, to the university and other times, you know, Welsh is the common thing I hear in the street. It's a common thing that people talk about. Yes, they know English too, but to integrate, it's not clear to me that it need only be English and that it can't be, say, other British languages, if for want of another categorization. So those would be a couple things that I would be keen to do. I would also be keen to look very closely at some of the family rules. So I'll just point out one. Again, I don't want to tell you more about the changes than you will care to hear. and I don't want to get too into the detail that might not be to every listener's interest, but take one example on families. So if you have a spouse and you're British and your spouse is not, and you want to bring your spouse here, you need to earn a certain level of money here in the UK. You cannot just kind of pack up your bags and arrive here without a job and have your spouse get an automatic spousal visa to stay. That's not how it works. Mm. You need to make money, and you need to make it here. One of the problems, one of the issues with that, justifications, is that if someone's earning above, say, £18,600, the thought is that that is somehow a guarantee that the spouse will not be eligible or not require any income-based welfare payments. It won't be based basically asking for a handout, to use language of the right. And so if that's the case, one problem with that is non-EU citizens, and potentially soon any non-UK citizen, will not have any direct access to benefits anyway. So to kind of say, like, we're doing this requirement to make sure you don't get benefits from the state, well, I had it in my passport that until I became a British citizen, that I had no recourse to public funds anyway. So that was not kind of a problem in the first place. So it was a curious thing to have someone else satisfy for me that I can't actually exercise. Mm. The other problem here is, what should it matter, provided that one person in the family earns that amount of money? What does it matter if it's the British citizen and not the other? Put it this way. If Melania Trump, for whatever reason, wanted to leave her husband, hypothetically speaking, and left the president for someone who was in the UK, she would need to find a British spouse that earned £18,600 or more to sponsor her for her to come, even though she will, if there's, you know, any truth to anything Trump says about how much money he's worth, or we may find out in a New York courtroom shortly whether or not it's actually true, she's arguably worth a few cool million. So even though she would not need any recourse to anyone's funds and is, by all accounts, will be very wealthy, certainly as a in her current situation and hypothetically would appear to be if she were to separate or divorce the president, as some speculate she might want to, then you know, she would be barred from coming here. Even though it just, it's kind of nonsensical that that would be the case, given, again, the justification about ensuring that that person doesn't have recourse to kind of welfare payments. Well, you know, why she wouldn't be in that position to, in that sense of being wealthy. So I would like to see something kind of change on that income, to take kind of a whole family view of income earned by the family, and not have it all fall only to the British party to do so, but to have a kind of more collective view. I think also, frankly, a more fair view. And I also, finally, I think there ought to be a proper kind of look and review about how the points work in the system, because of course two things motivate that. One is that the point system is of course still unknown, right? So we're months away from it allegedly being law of the land, but we still don't know what most of the points categories are going to look like. So the other thing that you heard about in the press from the government was stuff about having a degree was going to get you points. And you need, you know, the kind of degree possessing English-speaking people only. And none of these low-skilled folks will be allowed in. Well, of course, they have a – that's not going to be true either. But anyway, that's the public show that they give. But that's not true. So on the current table, it talks about having a PhD in one subject gets you a certain amount of points. Having a PhD in a science subject gets you even more points. But then when you actually read the further details, it tells you something different. It tells you that there's also going to be points, though arguably fewer, for a variety of different degrees, but they haven't figured out what those qualifications will earn you. They're also going to give you points based upon your experience. Don't ask me how. They're going to give you points based on non-degree possessing experience you have. How that will work and be evidenced by field. And so on and so forth. So I think, you know, that is a mess. A lot of the points we're still waiting to see how it will work. The income threshold itself, they say that there is a minimum threshold, but actually it's not fixed. It's there's a lot of caveats. They look at that compared to what 80% of a certain median in your field might earn in an entry level. The technicalities are breathtaking. Making a system that's already complex, already badly run, the Home Office already loses 60% of all appeals made against it because it gets it wrong. It's making a system it can barely handle for the single category of non-EU citizens mostly. It's making it far more complex, far more clunky, and worse. And so I would try to streamline it. I would try to simplify it. And I would try to make it more fair. And that would be what I would hope Labour would do. I would say a lot more, but I will stop there.
Now, one of the most controversial cases that is going up before the Supreme Court at the moment is that of Shamima Begum regarding the stripping of her British citizenship. Now, what are your thoughts on that?
That good one. So I got a shorter answer, Will. So you'll be delighted to hear. So on this, there was, I'm certain, pretty certain that the government is going to lose this case, and I'm probably as certain they're going to lose it in the Supreme Court as I was the Supreme Court was going to find a strong majority, if not unanimity, on the Peregation case. So pretty strong. This is partly because there is a precedent. I'm trying to recall, when Theresa May was some secretary, I believe, there was the case about stripping someone of his nationality while he was abroad, someone who was British. And I forget which country this person was claimed to belong to in addition to Britain, but the argument went like this, that there have been previous cases where the Home Office had stripped someone of citizenship and claimed that that they weren't really making the person stateless because of, we're trying to get away with it, and got into trouble because they were making the person stateless. And so then there was a test case, effectively, where Theresa May's team argued that someone being stripped of his British citizenship was not being made stateless because the Home Office had determined that if the person knocked on the door of the whatever other country, they ought to be entitled to an automatic passport from them. They had automatic right of citizenship. And so all they needed to do was ask. And so because the person could just kind of request it and get the thing, they were not necessarily making him stateless. He was only effectively stateless by choice and not kind of asking to have that passport. And so the Home Office was somehow not doing anything naughty. They weren't in breach of the law. And it went to the Supreme Court, and the court found that the Home Office just can't do that. shocker, that it's not for the British government to determine who is and is not a national of another country. You know, it's kind of like allowing the Canadians to tell us who's really a British citizen. So we have to take that terrorist back or terrorist suspect back because the Canadian court thinks that, or the Canadian government thinks that. That's the analog here, where the British government just kind of thinks somebody belongs to another country, and so therefore it's their problem because Britain has disowned somebody when the other country does. And the Supreme Court said, effectively, if someone's not already on the books, if someone's not already down listed as a citizen of that state, then it is not for the British government to say whether or not they are on that list. That is the sovereign decision of that other country. And and I think the point was made. We would want the same in return from anyone else. We don't want Bangladesh or America or Papua New Guinea telling us who's British and who's not. That's for Britain to determine who's a British citizen or not. But it goes likewise. And it's a kind of a curious blindness or hypocrisy of what one is demanding of others, that one is an exception to the rule somehow. This. So I think there's already the test case. I see nothing so far from the proceedings to make me think that the Supreme Court is going to go another way. I mean, at the end of the day, the facts of the case are plain, that however awful Shamima Begum's actions are, and I don't doubt for a second that they are, and I don't doubt there's lots of reasons on lots of policy grounds and other grounds to not want her back. She can't be stripped of her citizenship, given that she does not have citizenship to another country, and that's the end of it. Mm. And Bangladesh has already commented that because the government, I believe, says that she was entitled to Bangladeshi citizenship if she asked for it, or it was some automatic natural entitlement, and they said that they don't recognize her as a citizen. She's not on the list, and they're not about to make her a citizen either. So given that kind of evidence that the place that the Home Office says is her country says that no, mate, we are that country and we're telling you she's not. It seems that they're going to lose this case as they have lost ones before. So I think the specifics are that she's wanting to contest her right to appeal. I think it will be allowed, and I think that and I wouldn't be surprised if there's some kind of strong direction given about her entitlement to that. And I did a piece with a law program on Radio 4 a few months back with Lord Carlisle, the Liberal Democrat peer and a highly respected barrister, formerly was the inspector overseeing kind of the independent judiciary on terrorism. And Carlisle said that was spot on, that's absolutely the law and as he saw it, and there you are. So having kind of his saying that, and every other lawyer I've spoken to says the same, I think that the government will lose the case. So it raises the question, why the heck did they do it if they were going to lose? Answer, frankly, the usual dog whistle politics of, looking tough on immigrants to kind of win over popular, points and win elections, that it did the government more good to say in public that they were going to do something, even if the government knew that it was illegal, because, there was no real risk that if they got their way, that they kept the person out and achieved a policy objective. And if the person came back and was let in, then that might be another, stick they can use to beat the judiciary for when the government refuses to abide by the rule of law. So they probably saw it as a win-win situation, not having much regard overall for the rule of law.
Now, of course, you are a joint British and American citizen, and this year we'll be having a presidential election.
You most certainly are.
We most certainly are. if Joe Biden wins that election, how do you think the dynamic between him and Boris Johnson will work? Do you think that the special relationship will change? What do you think will happen?
Well, the first thing to say about President Biden is just, I'll take it. What did Churchill say of democracy? It's the, the worst except for all the rest. Given all the other viable candidates running right now, he seems to be the best of a worse lot, certainly better than Trump, so I'll take it. So I won't be jumping up and down when he wins, but I will breathe a heavy sigh of relief should he win, that someone could go to Donald and say, "You're fired." Of course, Trump does the apprentice version in the United States, or at least used to. And so it'll be good to have those words said to him. One of the strange things about the special relationship, I should call it the strange relationship, is that I never heard the phrase. I mean, I did an undergraduate degree in political science. I did my master's in political science. I took European political systems, so studied parliamentary democracy, though main focus was political theory and comparative government. But having minored in comparative government, I had never heard the phrase special relationship until I came to the UK. And it's always struck me as a one-sided viewpoint, where some British establishment, especially on the right, think that there's somehow something kind of special, often harping back to the Reagan-Thatcher years, but also, of course, to the Second World War, about something kind of very kind of dear and lovely and wonderful about their American cousins, and that there's some kind of closer bond between them and anybody else. I can tell you that I don't for a second think that that's true, or that view is held by about any U.S. president that immediately comes to mind in modern times. Yes, Bill Clinton will have had a fondness for the U.K., given work in Northern Ireland, given his wife, Hillary Clinton has a law school in Swansea named after her, so apparently the Rodhams have a distant Welsh relations, and so there's some connection there, and she comes back. I think she's the chancellor of the university. Anyway, there's fondness by all the presidents for the UK, no doubt, but do they give it an especially high regard above other countries? I'm afraid I don't see it reciprocated whatsoever. I mean, the American president, I think you can often tell priorities by who they pick up the phone and ring first. And the first phone call is just about never, to my recollection, 10 Downing Street. Prime Minister here doesn't get the first call. First usually goes to Canada. Canada shares a long land border, mostly land border, with the United States, a massive trade partner. America's NAFTA agreement, a big thing for Canada, U.S. and with Mexico. Canada is more of the special relationship type than Britain is by, I think, a very large margin. George W. Bush rang Vicente Fox, then the president of the Republic of Mexico. In Spanish. I think Bush is former governor of Texas, showing off a bit of his Espanol, and that there's something kind of different about him, that he was not going to prioritize the northern border, but he was going to be more friendly and open to the southern border, and how radically left-wing and progressive George W. Bush now looks. In fact, compared to the current occupant, Obama, before he, you know, we forget him, he rang Merkel when he became for his first call in one of his, I forget if it's the first or the second election. So the 10 Downing Street is not often the first port of call. I think far more Americans probably identify as having Irish heritage than British of some kind. Even Barack Obama said, you know, my last name's Obama. You know, even he claimed to have some kind of Irish thing on St. Patrick's Day as the national holiday of sorts, with national parades and so on. So I've never quite seen the special relationship with Britain. Yes, a warm connection, but not anything special. So I don't think Biden is going to kind of go out of his way to try to kind of do anything particular with Boris Johnson, given that Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are widely portrayed, not just in the media here, but also in the United States, as cut from a similar cloth of, you know, whether it be the hair, the figure, or the personal relationship issues, that the two of them are seen as cut from a similar type of cloth. And so I don't think it'll be particularly warm. And I think that Biden will be more likely to, well, will be attracted, I predict, with the EU, like Obama was before him. Why? Because the EU is the bigger trading bloc. It's the bigger market. And he'll be keen to open up markets for the United States more. And I think there'll be a huge focus on China. I think China, not necessarily a special relationship, of course, but I think that that's going to be one of the main foreign policy areas of interest, and Russia as well, but particularly for negative reasons, but for China for a myriad of reasons. And so Britain trying to kind of find its own way in the world and its new feet and doing new things will not be off the radar, but will not be of interest. And if I can make one other point, a lot of folks are saying, especially in the conservative party, about, you know, the need to kind of move quick on a deal with Trump, and how Trump is this wonderful opportunity to kind of race ahead with a positive deal that will show the benefits of a post-Brexit trade deal world that we enter. I truly wonder what world these people live in. And the reason I say that is not to undersell or to think that Britain's best days are behind it or something stupid like that. I don't think that at all. I think our best days are truly ahead of us. But I think they're foolish in terms of so badly misreading the president of the United States. You know, Donald Trump might be wrong. He's wrong about a lot of things, by the way. He might be wrong, but he thinks he's the smartest guy on the planet. I mean, it's pretty undeniable. You know, he's got lots of statements to that effect. He does seem to generally think he is smarter than you and I, though he might be wrong about that. He also might be wrong, but he genuinely believes, and he campaigns, and one of his biggest kind of things why you should vote for me wasn't just about building walls and stuff. He was the world's greatest deal maker. Nobody, in his view, was better at getting what he wants than Donald Trump. He knows all about making a buck and, you know, and taking advantage of the other guy. And he wrote a book, well, co-wrote, co-author, presumably, called The Art of the Deal, about his science for doing this kind of stuff. Someone who thinks that, again, he might be wrong. You know, maybe he can be outfooled. Maybe we could trick him into signing a treaty he thinks is better for America, but actually improves our side over his. And I take the point that trade deals are not necessarily zero-sum games and often are not zero-sum games. However, there was simply no possibility in any alternative universe that Donald Trump is going to agree a trade deal with anybody that he does not think in his heart will improve the relative position of the United States relative to another country. He's particularly keen, he says this when he's running for election, he's saying it now, he wants more and more of America's money staying put in America. He wants other countries to be, you know, to kind of have a situation where countries are paying America for the gratitude, the honor of doing trade with the United States. This is not a guy who's looking, hey, Boris, let me help you out, man. You know, let me be your buddy. Donald doesn't have friends, right? he's not a friendly guy from what reports we can see. And the thought that personal loyalty of anyone who wasn't directly related to him was going to count is just, you know, see what he's done to his advisors, the bodies scattered around Capitol Hill that he's left from, I mean, John Bolton, the things said about him, my God, I'm still trying to get over how those two aren't still best friends. You know, they seem to have everything in common except bombing Iran, apparently. But he's got no loyalty to people. And Theresa May running to him, first foreign leader to meet him on his election, holding his hand in the Rose Garden, you know, a woman, prime minister, who's strong, who doesn't have to do this. Now, Theresa May is better than that. I have respect for Theresa May. I don't have respect for policies in the Home Office she was doing. But, you know, she did want what was best for the country. I don't reject her. I do think she was had a good view of patriotism, just went about it all the wrong ways. And one of the big mistakes thinking that was going to get her anywhere with Trump, and it counted for nothing. And all he did immediately was big up Boris Johnson replacing her right around when he was getting ready to you know, when he kind of cut loose. And so, so it was just remarkable backstabbing. So on and so forth. So these folks who think, oh, Trump's our boy, you know, he's going to do all these things, it's going to be helpful, get this great trade deal. I don't know what they are smoking to come to those conclusions. I just think they need to put it out and put it, you know, and throw it away.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great speaking to you, Tom. And I've got one final question for you. If you could play any character in any historical TV series,
ooh,
who would you play?
Oh, goodness me. that is a good one. So historical television series.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my. This then gave you a kind of a terrific snapshot into my personal psychology, and others will ruminate for the rest of my career about what this shows about me. This is a great question. I don't know. I mean, growing up, I suppose I would embarrass myself a lot that I used to love this show, Good Times, about a black family in the United States trying to get by in difficult circumstances. The son of the guy who played the dad used to work at my father's shop when I was growing up. Got to know him, the family a bit, or bits about them, which was great. So I liked that show, and also was a big fan of the Jeffersons growing up. Another family with mixed friends and others on the east side in New York, and my favorite cartoon was Fat Albert. So I watched all these shows of not a lot of people look like me in them, but I just thought they were funny and great. I don't know if and I also watched the A-Team. Would I say I'm Hannibal versus I'm not B.A. Baracus. I'm definitely not Murdoch. Certainly not Face. So I don't know who on the A-Team I am. I don't know. I mean, maybe if I was to go to Scooby-Doo, maybe Maybe the chap whose name I forget, who wore the bandana that looked to me at the time like something that Eddie Van Halen was wearing,
playing
guitar for Van Halen. Maybe that was maybe that was my why I liked the guy, and maybe because I liked Eddie Van Halen and still do, maybe that figure in Scooby-Doo. Trying to kind of have a cool head in difficult situations and trying to kind of solve puzzles and riddles. I like doing that.
Well, I think that's a great choice. And like you say, I'm sure our listeners will puzzle over all of that.
There you go. Yeah, sorry it took me so long to get to Scooby-Doo, but there you are.
No,
you said childhood, and that was some of the kind of television I unfortunately saw at that time. Switching between Scooby-Doo and Fat Albert.
Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Tom.
A great joy. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Don't forget that you can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, or YouTube. You can follow us at Debated Podcast on Twitter. Like us, Debated Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to email us, either about appearing or making a comment or reaction to the episode you've heard or any other episodes, then email us thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.